They came from the high country, in the place we now call Wyoming, above the headwaters of the Arkansas River. They called themselves Numenu, which in their Shoshone language meant simply people. They were of the mountains, short, dark-skinned, heavy-limbed, squat-legged, and ungraceful. They were not the tall, lithe people of the upper plains, the Sioux and others, the models for the Indian from the old American nickel. They were descendants of the primitive hunters who had crossed the land bridge from Asia to America in successive migrations between 11,000 and 5,000 BC, and in the millennia that followed, they had scarcely advanced at all. They grubbed and hunted for a living, using stone weapons and tools, spearing rodents and other small game, and killing buffalo by setting the prairies on fire and stampeding the creatures over cliffs or into pits. They used the dog travois to travel, a frame slung between two poles pulled by a dog, lugging their hide teepees with them. There were perhaps 5,000 of them living in scattered bands. They squatted around fires, gorging themselves on charred, bloody meat. They fought, reproduced, suffered, and died. They were primitive, even by primitive standards. They had no agriculture, no music or art to speak of, and had never felled trees or woven baskets or made pottery or built houses. They had little or no social organization beyond the hunting band. Their culture contained no warrior societies, no permanent priest class. They had no sun dance. In social development, they were cultural eons behind the dazzlingly urban Aztecs or the stratified, highly organized, clan-based Iroquois. They were in all ways utterly unlike the tribes from the American Southeast, who in the period from AD 700 to 1700 built sophisticated cultures around maize agriculture that featured large towns, priest chiefs, clans, and matrilineal descent. On their immediate east were tribes, including the Missouris, Omahas, Pawnees, and Wichitas, who excelled at pottery and basketry, spun and wove fabric, practiced extensive agriculture, and built semi-permanent houses covered with grass, bark, or earth. The brutish Numenu knew none of those things. From all evidence, they were despised, scorned, and considered a tribe of little or no significance. It is interesting that the Comanches themselves possessed little tribal legend and very few songs. There was apparently nothing to tell, no good old days or glorious victories to celebrate. As late as the early 17th century, they were still trapped in this Stone Age darkness, an unclever people with no apparent way out. They had been driven to this harsh, difficult land on the eastern slope of the Rockies by other tribes, meaning that, in addition to everything else they were not good at, the Comanches were not very good at war, either. What happened to the tribe between roughly 1625 and 1750 was one of the great social and military transformations in history. Few nations have ever progressed with such breathtaking speed from the status of skulking pariah to dominant power. The change was total and irrevocable, and it was accompanied by a complete reordering of the balance of power on the American plains. The tribes that had once driven the Comanches into the mountains of Wyoming would soon be either dim memories, Kansas, Omahas, Missouris, or, like the Apaches, Utes, and Osages, fleeing to avoid extermination. The Numenu were like the small boy who is bullied in junior high school, then grows into a large, strong, and vengeful high schooler. Vengeance they were good at, and they had extremely long memories for evils done to them. It should be noted that the dull boy became suddenly very clever, too, and he went from being the least clever boy to the cleverest of all. The agent of this astonishing change was the horse. Or, more precisely, what this backward tribe of Stone Age hunters did with the horse, a piece of transformative technology that had as much of an effect on the Great Plains as steam and electricity had on the rest of civilization. The story of the Comanches' implausible ascent begins with the arrival of the first conquistadors in Mexico in the early 16th century. The invaders brought horses with them from Spain. The animals terrified the natives, provided obvious military superiority, and gave the Spaniards a sort of easy mobility never before seen by the inhabitants of the New World. The Spanish horses were also, by the purest of accidents, brilliantly suited to the arid and semi-arid plains and mesas of Mexico and the American West. The Iberian Mustang was a far different creature from its heavy-limbed, grain-fed cousin from farther north in Europe. It was a desert horse, one whose remote ancestors had thrived on the level, dry steppes of Central Asia. Down the ages, the breed had migrated to North Africa by way of the Middle East, mixing blood with other desert hybrids along the way. The Moorish invasions brought it to Spain. By that time, it had become, more or less, the horse that found its way to America. Light, small, and sturdy, barely 14 hands high, with a concave Arabian face and tapering muzzle. The horse didn't look like much, but it was smart, fast, trainable, bred to live off the grasses of the hot Spanish plains and to go long distances between watering holes. Possessed of great endurance, the animal could forage for food, even in winter. Thus, the Mustang immediately prospered in Mexico and enabled the Spanish, in haciendas around Mexico City, to become horse breeders on a grand scale. Barely 20 years after Cortés landed, Coronado was able to amass 1,500 horses and mules for his great northern expedition. As the Spanish conquest spread, so did their horses. Since they were fully aware of what might happen if indigenous tribes learned to ride, one of the very first ordinances they passed prohibited natives from riding any horse. They could not enforce such laws, of course. Ultimately, they needed Indians and mestizos to work their ranches. This meant that knowledge of how to groom, saddle, bridle, and break horses gradually passed from Spanish control into the hands of the locals. This transmission of Spanish horse culture began in Mexico in the 16th century and continued steadily as the Spaniards drove north to New Mexico in the 17th century. That was the first part of the horse revolution. The second was the dispersal of the horses themselves. This happened very slowly at first. The first real herd of horses in North America arrived with the expedition of Don Juan de Oñate to New Mexico in 1598. He brought with him 700 horses. The Spanish defeated, converted, and then enslaved the local Pueblo Indians, who built their forts and missions for them. The Indians also tended the horses, though they never showed any interest in using them for anything besides food. But the Pueblos were not the only Indians in New Mexico. By giving shelter and aid to them, the Spanish had incurred the wrath of local Athapascan bands, Apaches, who had conducted raids against settlements almost since they began. Now something quite interesting, and in the Spanish history of the Americas, unprecedented, happened. The Apaches began to adapt themselves to the horse. No one knows exactly how this happened, or precisely how they came into possession of the elaborate Spanish understanding of horses, but it was an amazingly swift transfer of technology. The Indians first stole the horses, then learned how to ride them. The horse culture was entirely copied from the Spanish. Indians mounted from the right, a practice the Spanish had taken from the Moors, and used crude replicas of Spanish bits, bridles, and saddles. The horse gave them astounding advantages as hunters. It also made them doubly effective as raiders, mainly because it afforded them an immediate and swift method of escape. According to Spanish records, mounted Apaches were conducting raids into New Mexican settlements as early as the 1650s. In spite of this auspicious start, the Apaches were never a great horse tribe. They did not fight on horseback and never learned the art of breeding, nor particularly cared to learn it. They used their Spanish Mustangs mainly for basic travel and had an inordinate fondness for cooked horse flesh, eating most of the ones they had and saving only the choicest for riding. They were also, always, a semi-agricultural tribe, which meant that their applications of the horse would always be limited, in ways that would later accrue entirely to the benefit of their greatest foes, the Comanches. But for now, they had what no other tribe in the Americas had. and they managed to cause an enormous amount of trouble. They began a relentless and deadly series of raids against the peaceful Pueblos, who were scattered in settlements from Taos to Santa Fe and south along the Rio Grande. The Apaches would attack and then disappear quickly into the western landscape, and the Spanish could neither stop them nor track them down. With each raid, too, they became richer in horses. In one raid alone, in 1659, they carried off 300. It became clear to the Pueblos, eventually, that the Spanish could not protect them. This was very likely the main reason for the Great Pueblo Revolt in 1680. There were other reasons, too, like the forced labor, the imposition of Catholicism, and the suppression of Pueblo culture and tradition. Whatever the cause, the Pueblos rose, and in a grisly, blood-soaked rebellion, drove the Spanish out of New Mexico for 10 years. Their imperial nemesis gone, the Indians lapsed into their old ways, which included pottery making and farming, but not horses, for which they had no use. Abandoned by the fleeing Spanish, thousands of mustangs ran wild into the open plains that resembled so closely their ancestral Iberian lands. Because they were so perfectly adapted to the new land, they thrived and multiplied. They became the foundation stock for the great wild mustang herds of the Southwest. This event has become known as the Great Horse Dispersal. The dissemination of so many horses to a group of 30 plains tribes permanently altered the power structure of the North American heartland. The Apaches had been the first North American Indians to understand what hunters and raiders could do with a horse. The other tribes would soon learn. The horse and the knowledge of how to use it spread with astonishing speed through the mid-continent. In 1630, no tribes anywhere were mounted. By 1700, all Texas Indian tribes had them. By 1750, tribes of the Canadian plains were hunting buffalo on horseback. The horse gave them what must have seemed to them an astonishing new mobility. It allowed them, for the first time, to fully master the buffalo. They could now migrate with the herds. They could now travel faster than a buffalo at full gallop, and they quickly learned to ride the huge creatures down on the open plains, thrusting their 14-foot lances between the animal's ribs, or shooting them on the run with arrows. Hunting skills quickly became martial skills, too. Tribes who learned to hunt on horseback gained an almost instant military dominance over non-horse tribes, and for a time, over everyone else who dared challenge them. It turned them into expansive traders, providing both the thing to be traded and the mobility to reach new markets. What the horse did not do was change their fundamental natures. Before the arrival of the horse, they were peoples whose lives were based almost entirely on the buffalo. The horse did not change this. They merely became much better at what they had always done. No true plains tribes fished or practiced agriculture before the horse, and none did so after the horse. Even their limited use of berries and roots went unchanged. They remained relatively primitive, warlike hunters. The horse virtually guaranteed that they would not evolve into more civilized agrarian societies. Still, the enhancements were breathtaking to see. War could now be made across immense distances. Horses, the principal form of wealth on the plains, could now be gathered and held in large numbers. And there was the simple, fundamental, spiritual power of the animal itself that had transformed these poor foot Indians into dazzling cavalrymen. And the new technology turned tribes who had lagged behind their peers in culture and social organization into newly dominant forces. These included names that would soon be famous throughout the country: Sioux, Cheyenne, Kiowa, Arapaho, Blackfoot, Crow, and Comanche. No one knows exactly how or when the Comanche bands in eastern Wyoming first encountered the horse, but that event probably happened somewhere near the midpoint of the 17th century. Since the Pawnees, who lived in the area we now call Nebraska, were known to be mounted by 1680, the Comanches almost certainly had horses by that time. There were no witnesses to this great coming together of Stone Age hunters and horses. nothing to record what happened when they met, or what there was in the soul of the Comanche that understood the horse so much better than everyone else did. Whatever it was, whatever sort of accidental brilliance, whatever the particular subliminal bond between warrior and horse, it must have thrilled these dark-skinned pariahs from the Wind River country. The Comanches adapted to the horse earlier and more completely than any other plains tribe. They are considered, without much debate, the prototype horse tribe in North America. No one could outride them or outshoot them from the back of a horse. No other horse tribe fought entirely mounted, as the Comanches did. Pawnees, Crows, even the Dakotas used the horse primarily for transport. They would ride to the battle, then dismount and fight. Only in the movies did the Apaches attack riding horses. No tribe other than the Comanches ever learned to breed horses, an intensely demanding, knowledge-based skill that helped create enormous wealth for the tribe. They were always careful in the castration of the herd. Almost all riding horses were geldings. Few other tribes bothered with this. It was not uncommon for a Comanche warrior to have 100 to 200 mounts, or for a chief to have 1,500. A Sioux chief might have 40 horses by comparison. They were not only the richest of all tribes in sheer horse flesh, their horses were also the main medium through which the rest of the tribes became mounted. The first Europeans and Americans to see Comanche horsemanship did not fail to notice this. Atanas de Maizière, a Spanish Indian agent of French descent, described them thus. "They are a people so numerous and haughty that when asked their number, they make no difficulty of comparing it to that of the stars. They are so skillful in horsemanship that they have no equal, so daring that they never ask for or grant truces, and in the possession of such a territory that, finding in it an abundance of pasturage for their horses and an incredible number of buffalo, which furnish them all the raiment, food, and shelter, they only just fall short of possessing all the conveniences of the earth." Other observers saw the same thing. Colonel Richard Dodge, whose expedition made early contact with Comanches, believed them to be the finest light cavalry in the world, superior to any mounted soldiers in Europe or America. Catlin also saw them as incomparable horsemen. As he described it, the American soldiers were dumbfounded at what they saw. "On their feet, they are one of the most unattractive and slovenly-looking races of Indians I have ever seen, but the moment they mount their horses, they seem at once metamorphosed," wrote Catlin. "I am ready, without hesitation, to pronounce the Comanches the most extraordinary horsemen I have ever seen yet in all my travels." He went on to write, "Amongst their feats of riding, there is one that has astonished me more than anything of the kind I have ever seen or expect to see in my life, a stratagem of war learned and practiced by every young man in the tribe, by which he is able to drop his body on the side of his horse at the instant he is passing, effectively screened from his enemy's weapons, as he lays in a horizontal position behind the body of his horse, with his heel hanging over the horse's back. In this wonderful condition he will hang whilst his horse is at fullest speed, carrying with him his bow and shield, and also his long lance, 14 feet in length." Thus positioned, a Comanche warrior could loose 20 arrows in the time it took a soldier to load and fire one round from his musket. Each of those arrows could kill a man at 30 yards. Other observers were amazed at the Comanche technique of breaking horses. A Comanche would lasso a wild horse, then tighten the noose, choking the horse and driving it to the ground. When it seemed as if the horse was nearly dead, the choking lariat was slacked. The horse finally rose, trembling and in a full lather. Its captor gently stroked its nose, ears, and forehead, then put his mouth over the horse's nostrils and blew air into its nose. The Indian would then throw a thong around the now gentled horse's lower jaw, mount up, and ride away. The Comanches, as it turned out, were geniuses at anything to do with horses, breeding, breaking, selling, and riding. They even excelled at stealing horses. Colonel Dodge wrote that a Comanche could enter a bivouac where a dozen men were sleeping, each with a horse tied to his wrist by the lariat, cut a rope within 6 feet of the sleeper, and get away with the horse without waking a soul. No other tribe, except possibly the Kiowas, so completely lived on horseback. Children were given their own horses at 4 or 5. Soon the boys were expected to learn tricks, which included picking up objects on the ground at a gallop. The young rider would start with light objects and move to progressively heavier objects until finally, without assistance and at a full gallop, he could pick up a man. Rescuing a fallen comrade was seen as one of the most basic obligations of a Comanche warrior. They all learned the leather thong trick at a young age. Women could often ride as well as men. One observer watched two Comanche women set out at full speed with lassos and each rope a bounding antelope on the first throw. Women had their own mounts, as well as mules and gentle horses for packing. When they were not stealing horses or breeding them, they were capturing them in the wild. General Thomas James told a story of how he had witnessed this in 1823 when he had visited the Comanches as a horse buyer. He watched as many riders headed bands of wild horses into a deep ravine where 100 men waited on horseback with coiled lariats. When the terrified wild horses reached the ambush, there was a good deal of dust and confusion as the riders lassoed them by the neck or forefeet. But every rider got an animal. Only one horse got away. The Comanches pursued him, and in 2 hours he came back tamed and gentle. Within 24 hours, 100 or more wild horses had been captured amid the wildest excitement and appeared to be as subject to their masters as farm horses. They would chase a herd of mustangs for several days until the animals were exhausted, making them easy to capture. Comanche waited by waterholes for parched horses to gorge themselves so they could barely run, then captured them. While the Comanches had a limited vocabulary to describe most things, a trait common to primitive peoples, their equine lexicon was large and minutely descriptive. For color alone, there were distinct Comanche words for brown, light bay, reddish brown, black, white, blue, dun, sorrel, roan, red, yellow, yellow horse with a black mane and tail, red, sorrel, and black pintos. There were even words to describe horses with red, yellow, and black ears. Comanche horsemanship also played a leading role in another Comanche pastime, gambling. Stories of Comanche horse hustles are legion. One of the more famous came from the Texas frontier. A small band of Comanche showed up at Fort Chadbourne, where the army officers challenged them to a race. The chief seemed indifferent to the idea, but the officers were so insistent that he agreed to it anyway. A race was arranged over a distance of 400 yards. Soon, a large, portly brave appeared on a long-haired, miserable sheep of a pony. He carried a heavy club, with which he hit the horse. Unimpressed, the officers trotted out their third-best horse and bet the Comanches flour, sugar, and coffee against buffalo robes. Swinging the club ostentatiously, the Indian won. For the next race, the soldiers brought out their second-best horse. They lost this race, too. Now they insisted on a third race and finally trotted out their number-one horse, a magnificent Kentucky mare. Bets were doubled, tripled. The Comanches took everything the soldiers could wager. At the starting signal, the Comanche warrior whooped, threw away his club, and went away like the wind. 50 yards from the finish, the Comanche rider turned fully around in his saddle and, with hideous grimaces, beckoned the other rider to catch up. The losers later learned that the same shaggy horse had just been used to take 600 horses off of the Kickapoo Indians. In the late 1600s, Comanche mastery of the horse had led them to migrate southward out of the harsh, cold lands of the Wind River and into more temperate climates. The meaning of the migration was simple. They were challenging other tribes for supremacy over the single richest hunting prize on the continent, the buffalo herds of the southern plains. In 1706, they rode for the first time into recorded history. In July of that year, a Spanish sergeant major named Juan de Ulibarri, on his way to gather Pueblo Indians for conversion in northern New Mexico, reported that Comanches, in the company of Utes, were preparing to attack Taos Pueblo. He later heard of actual Comanche attacks. This was the first the Spanish or any white man had heard of these Indians, who had many names. One name in particular, given to them by the Utes, was Comats, sometimes given as Comancia, and meant anyone who is against me all the time. The authorities in New Mexico translated this various ways, Comanche, Comanche, but eventually as Comanche. It would take the Spaniards years to figure out exactly who these new invaders were. 4. High Lonesome. With these remarks, I submit the following pages to the perusal of a generous public, feeling assured that before they are published, the hand that penned them will be cold in death. Those are the words of 20-year-old Rachel Parker Plummer, written probably sometime in early 1839. She was referring to her memoir of captivity and predicting her own death. She was right. She died on March 19th of that year. She had been dragged, sometimes quite literally, over half of the Great Plains as the abject slave of Comanche Indians, and then had logged another 2,000 miles in what amounted to one of the most grueling escapes ever made from any tribe by any captive. To the readers of her era, the memoir was jaw-dropping. It still is. As a record of pure, blood-tinged, white-knuckled adventure on America's 19th-century frontier, there are few documents that can compare to it. On the morning after that harrowing first night, the five Parker captives, Rachel and her 18-month-old son James, her aunt Elizabeth Kellogg, probably in her 30s, 9-year-old Cynthia Ann Parker, and her 7-year-old brother John, were strapped to horses behind Comanche riders again and taken north. For the next 5 days, the Comanches pressed hard, passing Cross Timbers, the 40-mile-wide patch of woods on the otherwise open prairie west of modern Dallas, a beautiful-faced country, as Rachel put it, with a great many fine springs. Not that she was allowed to drink from them. During that time, the Indians gave their captives no food at all, and only a single small allowance of water. Each night they were tied tightly with leather thongs that made their wrists and ankles bleed. As before, their hands and feet were drawn together, and they were put face down on the ground. Rachel does not tell us much about what happened to Cynthia Ann, beyond the blows, the blood, and the trussings of the first night, but it is possible to make an educated guess about what happened to her. Though Comanches were mercurial about these things, their treatment of a 9-year-old girl would usually have been different from that accorded the adult women. Cynthia Ann's first few days and nights were no doubt horrific. There was the shrieking panic of the Indian attack, the uncomprehending horror of the moment her mother, Lucy, set her on the warrior's horse, her own father's bloody death, the astonishing sight of her cousin and aunt being raped and abused. In spite of her strict Baptist upbringing, as a farm girl, she would have known about sex and reproduction. Still, it would have shed little light on what she witnessed. There was the hard ride through the prairie darkness of northern Texas to the camp where she was tied and bludgeoned, then the 5 subsequent days on the trail without food. Considering what happened to her later, however, it is likely that the beatings and harsh treatment stopped. There are plenty of records of children being killed by Comanches and of young girls being raped, but in general, they fared far better than the adults. For one thing, they were young enough to be assimilated into a society that had abysmally low fertility rates, partly caused by the life on horseback, which induced miscarriages early in pregnancy, and needed captives to keep their numbers up. They were also valuable for the ransom they might bring. In several other unusually violent Comanche raids, young female captives had been conspicuously spared and quickly accepted into the tribe. Girls had a decent chance, anyway. Certainly that was true compared to adult male captives, who were automatically killed or tortured to death. The strongest argument for her humane treatment was the presence at the Parker raid of the man who would later become her husband and a war chief, Peeta Nokona. Indeed, Peeta may well have led the raid, and it may have been his horse upon which Lucy Parker had put the screaming, protesting Cynthia Ann. On the sixth day, the Indians divided their captives. Elizabeth Kellogg was traded or given to a band of Quechua Indians, a sedentary tribe from north-central Texas that raised crops and enjoyed something like vassal status with the Comanches. Cynthia Ann and John went to a band of Middle Comanches, probably the Nokonis. Rachel and James went to another Comanche band. She had assumed that they would let her son, bruised and bloody but somehow still alive, stay with her. She was wrong. "As soon as they found out I had weaned him," she wrote, "they, in spite of all my efforts, tore him from my embrace. He reached out his hands toward me, which were covered with blood, and cried, 'Mother, mother, oh mother!' I looked after him as he was born from me, and I sobbed aloud. This was the last I ever heard of my little Pratt." Rachel's band pushed on to the cooler elevations in the north, probably into what is now eastern Colorado. She found herself on the high, barren plains. "We now lost sight of timber," Rachel wrote. "We would travel for weeks and not see a riding switch. Buffalo dung is all the fuel. This is gathered into a round pile, and when set on fire, it does very well to cook by, and will keep fire for several days." They were in the heart of Comancheria, an utterly alien place that was known to mapmakers of the time as the Great American Desert. To anyone accustomed to timbered lands, which describes almost everyone in America prior to 1840, the plains were not just unlike anything they had ever seen, they were, on some fundamental level, incomprehensible, as though a person who had lived in the high mountains all his life were seeing the ocean for the first time. East of the Mississippi, civilization stood on three legs: land, water, and timber, wrote Walter Prescott Webb in his classic The Great Plains. West of the Mississippi, not one but two of those legs were withdrawn, water and timber, and civilization was left on one leg, land. It is a small wonder that it toppled over in temporary failure. If there existed an implacably hostile human barrier to Spanish, French, and American advance in the form of the Plains Indians, there also existed an actual physical barrier. For people living in the 21st century, this is hard to imagine, because the land today is not as it was in the 19th century. Almost all of the American landscape has now been either farmed, ranched, logged, or developed in some way, and in many parts of the country, the raw distinctions between forest and prairie have been lost. But in its primeval state, almost all of North America, from the eastern coast to the 98th meridian, a line of longitude that runs north to south, roughly through the modern cities of San Antonio, Oklahoma City, and Wichita, was densely timbered, and the contrast between the dense eastern woodlands and the big sky country of the west would have been stark. A traveler going west would have seen nothing like open prairie until he hit the 98th meridian, whereupon, in many places, he would have been literally staring out of a dark Grimm Brothers forest at a treeless plain. It would have seemed to him a vast emptiness. At that point, everything the pioneer woodsman knew about how to survive, including building houses, making fire, and drawing water, broke down. It was why the plains were the very last part of the country to be settled. The main reason was rainfall, or lack of it. Just west of the 98th, the annual rainfall dropped below 20 inches. When that happens, trees find it hard to survive. Rivers and streams become sparse. The ecology of the plains was, moreover, one of fire. Constant lightning, or Indian-induced conflagrations that cut enormous swaths through the plains and killed most saplings that did not live in river or stream bottoms. A traveler coming out of humid, swampy, rain-drenched, pine-forested, river-crossed Louisiana would have hit the first prairie somewhere south of present-day Dallas, not very far from Parker's Fort. Indeed, one of the reasons Parker's Fort marked the limit of settlement in 1836 was that it was very near the edge of the Great Plains. That land consisted of rolling, creased plains dotted with timber. There was thicker timber in the bottoms of the Navasota River. From the Parkers' point of view, this was quite deliberate. They built a stockade fort, after all, of cedar. But 100 miles west, there would have been no timber at all, and by the time the traveler reached modern-day Lubbock and Amarillo, he would have seen nothing but a dead flat and infinitely receding expanse of grama and buffalo grasses, through which only a few gypsum-laced rivers ran, and on which few landmarks, if any, would have been distinguishable. Travelers of the day described it as oceanic, which was not a term of beauty. They found it empty and terrifying. They also described it as trackless, which was literally true. All traces of a wagon train rolling through plains grass would disappear in a matter of days, vanishing like beach footprints on an incoming tide. Not only were the high plains generally without timber and water, they were also subject to the most hostile climate in North America. In the summer came brutal heat and blowtorch winds, often 100 degrees or hotter, that would later destroy whole crops in a matter of days. The winds caused the eyes to burn, the lips to crack, and the body to dehydrate with alarming speed. In fall and winter, there was the frequent norther, a sudden strong wind from the north, often at gale force, accompanied by a solid sheet of black clouds and enormous billowing clouds of blown sand. A norther could send the temperature plunging up to 50 degrees in an hour. A blue norther had the additional feature of freezing-driven rain. This was routine weather on the plains. Worst of all was the blizzard. People from the east or west coasts of America may think they have seen a blizzard. Likely they have not. It is almost exclusively a phenomenon of the plains, and got its name on the plains. It entailed wind-driven snow so dense and temperatures so cold that anyone lost in them on the shelterless plains was as good as dead. In the years after the plains were settled, it was not unusual for people to become lost and die while walking from their barns to their houses. Howling winds blew for days. 40 to 50 foot snowdrifts were common, as were whiteouts, where it no longer became possible to tell the ground from the air. Plains blizzards swallowed whole army units, settlements, and Indian villages. This, too, was Comancheria, the beautiful and unremittingly hostile place they had chosen, the southernmost and richest range of the American buffalo. This was the very last part of the continent conquered and held by the U.S. Army, the last part anyone wanted, the last part civilized. The land alone stood a good chance of killing you. The fact that it was inhabited by Comanches and other mounted Indians made death something of a certainty. This is where Rachel Plummer was now, very likely 500 miles beyond the nearest settlement, in a place where only a few white men had ever been. From a settler's viewpoint, this was just empty territory, part of the United States by dint of the Louisiana Purchase, 1803, but without forts or soldiers or even human beings beyond the odd trapper or explorer or occasional mule train along the nearby Santa Fe Trail. The first caravans would not roll across the Oregon Trail for 4 years. This was Indian land, lived on by Indians, hunted by Indians, and fought over by Indians. In Rachel's account, she spent much of her 13 months of captivity on the high plains, though she also describes a journey through the Rocky Mountains, where I suffered more from cold than I ever suffered in my life before. It was very seldom I had anything to put on my feet, but very little covering for my body. She was a slave and was treated like one. Her job was to tend the horses at night and to dress buffalo skins by day, with a quota that she had to fill every full moon. This process involved painstakingly scraping all the flesh off the skin with a sharp bone. Lime was then applied to absorb grease, then the brains of the buffalo were rubbed all over it until it became soft. To make the quota and avoid a beating, she often took her buffalo skins with her while she tended the horses. She had been given to an old man and thus had become the servant of his wife and daughter, both of whom mistreated her. Rachel's kidnapping may seem the somewhat random product of a random raid on a Texas settlement. There were, in fact, important reasons for what had happened to her, all related to the highly specialized buffalo economy of the plains. Hides and robes had always been useful trading items. Comanche trade rested on horses, hides, and captives. The hides were rising in value, so much so that while an individual Comanche might eat only 6 buffalo per year, he would now kill an average of 44 per year, and the number grew every year. The women, of course, did all the value-added work, preparing the hides and decorating the robes. The men of the plains soon realized that the more wives they had, the greater their production of hides would be, thus the more manufactured goods they could trade for. This simple commercial fact had two important effects. First, an increase in polygamy among Indian men, and second, a desire to seize and hold more women captives. These changes were perhaps more instinctive than deliberate among the Comanches, but it meant that Rachel's days would always be long and hard, and that she would always have to meet her quotas. She was also, unfortunately, pregnant. She had been 4 months pregnant at the time of the Parker raid, and had borne all of this misery in advancing stages of pregnancy. In October 1836, she gave birth to her second son. She knew immediately that the child was in danger. She spoke the Comanche language well enough to, as she put it, expostulate with my mistress to advise me what to do to save my child. To no avail. Her master thought the infant too much trouble, and feeding him meant that Rachel was not able to work full time. One morning, when the baby was 7 weeks old, half a dozen men came. While several of them held Rachel, one of them strangled the baby, then handed him to her. When he showed signs of life, they took him again, this time tying a rope around his neck and dragging him through prickly pear cactus, and eventually dragged him behind a horse around 100-yard circuit. My little innocent one was not only dead, but literally torn to pieces, wrote Rachel. The tribe moved on. In spite of what she had been through, Rachel somehow kept up her daily routines. She managed to note details of the flora, fauna, and geography of what she saw. She wrote about prairie foxes, mirages of cool blue lakes that would appear magically in front of her, and shell fossils on the open plains. In what amounted to the first ethnography of the tribe, she noted details of Comanche society. The group moved every 3 or 4 days. The men danced every night. Some worshipped pet crows or deerskins. Before going into battle, the men would drink water every morning until they vomited. Taboos included never allowing a human shadow to fall across cooking food. When she had free time, she climbed to the top of mountains and even explored a cave. With her new grasp of the language, she was able to eavesdrop on a large Indian powwow near the headwaters of the Arkansas River. Since women were not allowed in tribal councils, I was several times repulsed with blows, she wrote, but I cheerfully submitted to abuse and persevered in listening to their proceedings. She overheard a plan for a large-scale, multi-tribe invasion of Texas. After taking Texas and driving out the inhabitants, they would attack Mexico. The attack was to come either in 1838 or 1839. In spite of Rachel's amazing resilience, she began to lose hope. She believed that her son James was probably dead, and that her husband, father, and mother had probably not survived the attack at Parker's Fort. She had almost no hope of escaping or of ever changing her status in the tribe. Despondent, suicidal, but unable to kill herself, she decided to provoke her captors into doing the job for her. After being ordered by her captor's daughter, my young mistress, to get a root-digging tool from the lodge, she refused. The young woman screamed at her, then ran at her. Rachel threw her onto the ground, held her down, fighting and screaming, and began beating her over the head with a buffalo bone, expecting, at every moment, to feel a spear reach my heart from one of the Indians. If they were going to kill her, she was determined at least to make a cripple of her captor. As this unfolded, she realized that a large crowd of Comanche men had gathered around them. They were all yelling, but no one touched her. She won the fight. I had her past hurting me, and indeed nearly past breathing, when she cried out for mercy, wrote Rachel. She let go of her adversary, who was bleeding freely, then picked her up, carried her back to the camp, and washed her face. For the first time, the woman seemed friendly. Not so her mother, who told Rachel she intended to burn her to death. She had burned Rachel before with fire and hot embers. Now Rachel and the old woman fought, in and around the roaring fire. Both were badly burned. Rachel knocked the woman into the fire twice and held her there. During the fight, they broke through one side of the teepee. Again, a crowd of men assembled to watch them. Again, no one intervened. Again, Rachel won. The following morning, 12 chiefs assembled at the council house to hear the case. All three women testified. The verdict? Rachel was sentenced to replace the lodge pole she had broken. She agreed, provided that the young woman helped her. After that, Rachel says, all was peace again. It is impossible to read Rachel Plummer's memoir without making moral judgments about the Comanches. The torture killing of a defenseless 7-week-old infant, by committee decision no less, is an act of almost demonic immorality by any modern standard. The systematic gang rape of women captives seems to border on criminal perversion, if not some very advanced form of evil. The vast majority of Anglo-European settlers in the American West would have agreed with those assessments. To them, Comanches were thugs and killers, devoid of ordinary decency, sympathy, or mercy. Not only did they inflict horrific suffering, but from all evidence, they enjoyed it. This was perhaps the worst part, and certainly the most frightening part. Making people scream in pain was fun for them, just as it is fun for young boys in modern-day America to torture frogs or pull the legs off grasshoppers. Boys presumably grow out of that. For Indians, it was an important part of their adult culture, and one they accepted without challenge. A story from the early 1870s illustrates the larger point. According to the account of a former child captive named Herman Lehman, who later became a full-fledged warrior, a group of Comanches had attacked some Tonkawa Indians in their camp. They had killed some of them and ran off the rest. In the abandoned camp, they found some meat roasting in the fire. It turned out to be the leg of a Comanche. The Tonkawas, known for their cannibalism, had been preparing a feast. This sent the Comanches into a fury of vengeance, and they pursued the Tonkawas. A fierce battle followed, in which 8 Comanches were killed and 40 were wounded. Still, they were victorious, and now, in the battle's aftermath, they turned to deal with the enemy's wounded and dying. "A great many were gasping for water," wrote Lehman, who was there, "but we heeded not their pleadings. We scalped them, amputated their arms, cut off their legs, cut out their tongues, and threw their mangled bodies and limbs upon their own campfire, put on more brushwood, and piled the living, dying, and dead Tonkaways on the fire. Some of them were able to flinch and work as worms, and some were able to speak and plead for mercy. We piled them up, put on more wood, and danced around in great glee as we saw the grease and blood run from their bodies, and were delighted to see them swell up and hear the hide pop as it would burst in the fire." This sort of cruelty is a problem in any narrative about American Indians, because Americans like to think of their native Aboriginals in some ways heroic or noble. Indians were, in fact, heroic and noble in many ways, especially in defense of their families. Yet in the moral universe of the West, in spite of our own rich tradition of torture, which includes officially sanctioned torments in Counter-Reformation Europe and sovereign regimes such as that of Peter the Great in Russia and Adolf Hitler in Germany, a person who tortures or rapes another person, or who steals another person's child and then sells him, cannot possibly be seen that way. Crazy Horse was undoubtedly heroic in battle and remarkably charitable in life, but as an Oglala Sioux, he was also a raider, and raiding meant certain very specific things, including the abuse of captives. His great popularity, a giant stone image of him is being carved from a mountain in South Dakota, may have a great deal to do with the fact that very little is known about his early life. He is free to be the hero we want him to be. Thus, some chroniclers ignore the brutal side of Indian life altogether. Others, particularly historians who suggest that before white men arrived, Indian-to-Indian warfare was a relatively bloodless affair involving a minimum of bloodshed, deny it altogether. But certain facts are inescapable. American Indians were warlike by nature, and they were warlike for centuries before Columbus stumbled upon them. They fought over hunting grounds, to be sure, but they also made a good deal of brutal and bloody war that was completely unnecessary. The Comanches' relentless and never-ending pursuit of the hapless Tonkawas is a good example of this, as is their harassment of Apaches long after they had been driven from the buffalo grounds. The object of war was simple. Kill your enemy, if possible also denying him a happy afterlife, hence scalping or decapitation. If you capture him alive, torture him to death. Steal his livestock and his children. Such behavior was common to all Indians in the Americas. The more civilized agrarian tribes of the East, in fact, were far more adept at devising lengthy and agonizing tortures than the Comanches or other Plains tribes. The difference lay in the Plains Indians' treatment of female captives and victims. Rape or abuse, including maiming of females, had existed when Eastern tribes had sold captives as slaves in the 17th and 18th centuries, but that practice had been long ago abandoned. Some tribes, including the giant Iroquois Federation, had never treated women captives that way. Women could be killed and scalped, but not gang-raped. What happened to the Parker captives could only have happened west of the Mississippi. If the Comanches were better known for cruelty and violence, that was because, as one of history's great warring peoples, they were in a position to inflict far more pain than they ever received. Most important, the Indians themselves saw absolutely nothing wrong with these acts. For Westering settlers, the great majority of whom believed in the idea of absolute good and evil, and thus of universal standards of moral behavior, this was nearly impossible to understand. Part of it had to do with the Comanches' theory of the nature of the universe, which was vastly different from that of the civilized West. Comanches had no dominant, unified religion. They did not bow to the will of a single god. Though in interviews after their defeat, they often seemed to go along with the idea of a great spirit, Comanche ethnographers Ernest Wallace and E. Adamson Hobel were extremely skeptical of any creation myths that involved a single spirit or an evil one. "We never gave much consideration to creation," said an old Comanche named Post Oak Jim in an interview in the 1930s. "We just knew we were here. Our thoughts were mostly directed toward understanding the spirits." The Comanches lived in a world alive with magic and taboo. Spirits lived everywhere, in rocks, trees, and in animals. The main idea of their religion was to find a way to harness the powers of these spirits. Such powers thus became puja, or medicine. There was no dogma, no priestly class to impose systematic religion, no tendency to view the world as anything but a set of isolated episodes with no deeper meaning or unfolding scheme. Nor did there exist any idea of moral elevation or doctrine of rewards and punishments. There were behavioral codes, to be sure. A man could not steal another man's wife without paying penalties, for example. But there was no ultimate good and evil, just actions and consequences, injuries and damages due. Enemies, meanwhile, were enemies, and the rules for dealing with them had come down through 1,000 years. A Comanche brave who captured a live Ute would torture him to death without question. It was what everyone had always done, what the Sioux did to the Assiniboine, what the Crow did to the Blackfoot. A Comanche captured by a Ute would expect to receive exactly the same treatment, thus making him weirdly consistent with the idea of the Golden Rule, which was why the Indians always fought to their last breath on the battlefields, to the astonishment of Europeans and Americans. There were no exceptions. Of course, the same Indians also believed, quite as deeply, in blood vengeance. The life of the warrior tortured to death would be paid for with another torture killing if possible, preferably even more hideous than the first. This, too, was seen as fair play by all Indians in the Americas. What explains such a radical difference in the moral systems of the Comanches and the whites they confronted? Part of it has to do with the relative progress of civilizations in the Americas compared to the rest of the world. The first truly important event in human history was the discovery of agriculture, which took place in Asia and in the Middle East, roughly simultaneously, around 6500 BC. It allowed the transition from nomadic, hunter-gatherer societies to the higher civilizations that followed. But in the Americas, farming was not discovered until 2500 BC, fully 4,000 years later, and well after advanced cultures had already sprung up in Egypt and Mesopotamia. This was an enormous gap. Once the Indians figured out how to plant seeds and cultivate crops, civilizations in North and South America progressed at roughly the same pace as they had in the Old World. Cities were built. Highly organized social structures evolved. Pyramids were designed. Empires were assembled, of which the Aztecs and Incas were the last. As in the Old World, nomadism and hunter-gatherer cultures persisted alongside the higher civilizations. But the Americas, isolated, and in any case without the benefit of the horse or the ox, could never close the time gap. They were 3 to 4 millennia behind the Europeans and Asians, and the arrival of Columbus in 1492 guaranteed that they would never catch up. The non-agrarian Plains Indians, of course, were even farther behind. Thus, the fateful clash between settlers from the culture of Aristotle, St. Paul, Da Vinci, Luther, and Newton, and Aboriginal horsemen from the Buffalo Plains happened as though in a time warp, as though the former were looking backward thousands of years at premoral, pre-Christian, low-barbarian versions of themselves. The Celtic peoples, ancestors of huge numbers of immigrants to America in the 19th century, offer a rough parallel. Celts of the 5th century BC were described by Herodotus as fierce warriors who fought with seeming disregard for their own lives. Like Comanches, they were savage, filthy, wore their hair long, and had a hideous, keening battle cry. They were superb horsemen, inordinately fond of alcohol, and did terrible things to their enemies and captives that included decapitation, a practice that horrified the civilized Greeks and Romans. The old Celts, forebears of the Scots-Irish who formed the vanguard of America's western migrations, would have had no moral problem with the Comanche practice of torture. To their enemies, the Comanches were implacable buffalo-horned killers, grim apostles of darkness and devastation. Inside their own camps, however, where Rachel Parker Plummer, Cynthia Ann Parker, and others now found themselves, they were something entirely different. Here, wrote Colonel Richard Irving Dodge, one of the first Americans to observe them closely, the Comanche is a noisy, jolly, rollicking, mischief-loving braggadocio, brimful of practical jokes and rough fun of any kind. Rousing the midnight echoes with song and dance, whoops and yells. He loved to gamble and would bet on anything, absolutely anything, but especially on horses and games of chance, and would happily wager his last deerskin. He loved to sing. He especially loved to sing his personal song, often written expressly for him by a medicine man. He often woke up singing and sang before he went to bed. He adored games of any kind, but more than anything else in the world, he liked to race horses. He was vain about his hair, often weaving his wife's shorn tresses in with his own to create extensions, as modern women do. He would roll those extensions in beaver or otter skin. He was an incurable gossip and had, according to Dodge, a positive craving to know what is going on around him. He would dance for hours or days. He doted on his family, especially on his sons, and spent winters snug and indolent, wrapped in thick buffalo robes by the fire in his teepee, a brilliant piece of architectural design that required only a small fire to keep him warm even during the frigid, wind-lashed plains winters. And he loved to talk. "He will talk himself wild with excitement," wrote Dodge, "vaunting his exploits in love, war, on the chase, and will commit all sorts of extravagances while telling." His fellow tribe members had names like "A Big Fall by Tripping," "Face Wrinkling Like Getting Old," "Coyote Vagina," "Gets to be a Middle-Aged Man," "Always Sitting Down in a Bad Place," "Breaks Something," and "She Invites Her Relatives." To others, they were the personification of death. To themselves, they were simply people. They were, in most ways, typical Plains Indians. The culture of all true Plains tribes was built around the buffalo, which provided life's essentials: food, lodging, teepees made of hides, fuel, dried dung, tools, bone implements, water pouches made from the paunch, tack, bridles, thongs, and saddles made of hide, ropes from twisted hair, clothing, buckskins, moccasins, and fur robes, and weapons, bowstrings made from sinews, and clubs. Before the arrival of the buffalo hunters in the 1870s, the huge, swift, and profoundly stupid animals were literally too numerous to count. The larger part of this population lived on the southern plains, Comancheria. They were the reason the newly mounted tribe had fought for that land in the first place. In spite of its stupidity, the buffalo was a dangerous creature to hunt. A healthy buffalo could run nearly as fast as an ordinary horse for 2 miles. Because it was the Indian practice to ride up on it from behind, shooting or lancing it, the wounded buffalo was thus an immediate threat to the rider. The danger, as Texas Ranger Rip Ford wrote, was to be caught and lifted, horse and all, upon the horns of so huge a beast, tossed like a feather so many feet in the air, to fall all mixed up with your four-footed companion. Indian ponies were trained to turn instantly away from the buffalo at the twang of the bowstring. Buffalo was the food the Comanches loved more than any other. They ate steaks cooked over open fires or boiled in copper kettles. They cut the meat thin, dried it, and stored it for the winter and took it on long trips. They ate the kidneys and the paunch. Children would rush up to a freshly killed animal, begging for its liver and gallbladder. They would then squirt the salty bile from the gallbladder onto the liver and eat it on the spot, warm and dripping blood. If a slain female was giving milk, Comanches would cut into the udder bag and drink the milk mixed with warm blood. One of the greatest delicacies was the warm, curdled milk from the stomach of a suckling calf. If warriors were on the trail and short of water, they might drink the warm blood of the buffalo straight from its veins. Entrails were sometimes eaten, stripped of their contents by using 2 fingers. If fleeing pursuers, a Comanche would ride his horse till it dropped, cut it open, remove its intestines, wrap them around his neck, and take off on a fresh horse, eating their contents later. In the absence of buffalo, Comanches would eat whatever was at hand. Dry land terrapins, thrown live into the fire, eaten from the shell with a horn spoon. All manner of small game, even horses if they had to, though they did not, like the Apaches, prefer them. They did not eat fish or birds unless they were starving. They never ate the heart of the buffalo. The Comanches were also true Plains Indians in their social structure. Numina were organized in bands, a concept white men never quite understood. They insisted on looking at the Comanches as a tribe, meaning a single political unit with a head chief and, presumably, a cadre of civil and military subchiefs to do his bidding. This was never true, nor was it true of the Cheyennes or the Arapahoes or anyone else on the plains. Comanches all spoke the same language, dressed roughly in the same way, shared the same religious beliefs and customs, and led a common style of life that distinguished them from other tribes and from the rest of the world. That life, however, according to ethnographers Wallace and Hobel, did not include political institutions or social mechanisms by which they could act as a tribal unit. There was no big chief, no governing council, no Comanche nation that you could locate in a particular place, negotiate with, or conquer in battle. To whites, of course, this made no sense at all. It resembled no governing system they recognized. Across the plains, they insisted on making treaties with band headmen, often very colorful, strong-willed, and powerful ones, assuming incorrectly that the headmen spoke for the entire tribe. They would make this mistake again and again. The bands were always difficult for outsiders to understand. It was difficult to distinguish between them, or even to know how many bands there were. They occupied different, vaguely defined pieces of Comanche territory and were distinguished by small cultural nuances that eluded the unpracticed eye. One liked a particular dance, another an item of clothing, one liked to eat pemmican, another pronounced its words more slowly than the other bands. The Spanish, seeing the world from the far western edge of Comanche country, thought there were three bands. They were wrong, though they were right that they had probably had contact with only three. Texas Indian agent Robert Neighbors, one of the keenest observers of the tribe, said in 1860 he thought there were eight. Other observers counted as many as 13, some of which eventually disappeared, were absorbed, or were exterminated. Historians generally agree that there were five major bands at the turn of the 19th century. Most of the discussion in this book will focus on them. Each contained more than 1,000 people. Some perhaps had as many as 5,000. At its zenith, the entire nation was estimated at 20,000. They were the Yamparica, Yap Eaters, the northernmost band, who inhabited the lands to the south of the Arkansas River, the Kotsuthika, Buffalo Eaters, whose main grounds were the Canadian River Valley in present-day Oklahoma and the Texas Panhandle, the Penetica, Honey Eaters, the largest and southernmost band whose territory stretched deep into Texas, the Noconee, Wanderers, Middle Comanches, who occupied the lands in North Texas and present-day Oklahoma between the Penetica and the northern bands, finally, the Quahadis, Antelopes, Quanah's band, which haunted the headstreams of the Colorado, Brazos, and Red Rivers in far northwest Texas. Each band played a different part in history. The Penaticas were the ones largely responsible for driving the Lipan Apaches into the Mexican borderlands and fought most of the first battles against the Texans. The Kotsuthikas were the main raiders of the Spanish settlements in New Mexico. The Yamparicas battled the Cheyennes and Arapahoes on the northern borderlands of Comancheria. The Noconees attacked Parker's Fort. The Quahadis fought the last battles against the U.S. Army. All cooperated with one another on the friendliest of terms. All had, almost invariably, the same interests at heart. They hunted and raided together on an informal, ad hoc basis and frequently swapped members. They never fought each other. They always had common interests, common enemies, and in spite of their decentralization, acted with remarkable consistency when it came to diplomacy and trade. Other tribes had band structures that were even harder for whites to understand. Sitting Bull, for example, was a member of the Sioux tribe, but his affiliation was with the Lakota, or Western Division, also known as Teton, and his specific band was Hunkpapa. The Comanches, as a tribe, were thus without a center. But even within the band, their political structures were remarkably non-hierarchical, and their headmen wielded only limited power. There were usually two main chiefs in each band, one peace or civil chief, and one war chief. Though the former was usually superior to the latter, he exercised nothing like absolute control over individual band members, and there was nothing institutional about his power. There were indeed some very strong Comanche chiefs who commanded great allegiance, but they retained their power only so long as people went along with them. The civil chief's main job was that of a billeting officer, the man who said when the tribe would move and where it would go. He sat with a council that would rule on individual cases of theft, adultery, or murder, or whatever crime might come before them. But there was no consistent body of traditional law, no police, and no judges. It was, in effect, a system of private law. If a wrong was committed, then it was up to the wronged party to litigate it. Otherwise, there would be no enforcement. Payment for damages usually came in the form of horses. The head war chief, meanwhile, was a grand and glorious warrior, but was not actually in charge of many of the war or raiding parties that went out, nor could he determine who joined them or where they went. These were gathered by individual warriors with individual notions about where they wanted to go. In Comanche society, anyone could be a war chief. It meant simply that you had an idea to raid, say, Mexican ranchos in Coahuila, and were able to gather a sufficient number of warriors to do it. Head war chiefs got that way because they were good at recruiting war parties. They would inevitably lead the most important sorties and would lead the most important expeditions against powerful enemies, but they did not control, nor would they have wanted to, the martial plans of individual braves. Since discipline and authority were lacking at the tribal and band levels, one might expect that the power of the families or clans made up for this. But here, too, the Comanche was remarkably free of the usual social fetters. Though the family was clearly the basis of the band, the bands were never organized around a family group, nor were families even the main force in the regulation of marriage. There were no clan organizations of any kind. A family could not prevent a daughter or son from marrying outside of his or her band, and could not even prevent a family member from leaving the band. There was no principle of heredity in leadership, which was based entirely on merit. The Comanche male was thus gloriously, astoundingly free. He was subject to no church, no organized religion, no priest class, no military societies, no state, no police, no public law, no domineering clans or powerful families, no strict rules of personal behavior, nothing telling him he could not leave his band and join another one, nothing even telling him he could not abscond with his friend's wife, though he certainly would end up paying somewhere between 1 and 10 horses for that indulgence, assuming he was caught. He was free to organize his own military raids, free to come and go as he pleased. This was seen by many people, particularly writers and poets from James Fenimore Cooper onward, as a peculiarly American sort of freedom. Much was made of the noble and free life of the American savage. It was, indeed, a version of that freedom, especially from onerous social institutions, that drew many settlers west to the primitive frontier. This was the culture in which Rachel Plummer found herself. If there was much joy, laughter, singing, and gaming among the men, there was little left for her. As a woman, she was a second-class citizen, a member of a caste whose lot it was to do most of the hard work, including herding, skinning, butchering, drying beef, making clothing, packing, and repairing teepees. And, of course, tending to children and all family matters. As a captive woman, she had even fewer rights, and having been taken as an adult, she was never likely to get any more than she had. She bore the scars of her initial captivity and from punishments she had received. Those who saw her later said she was quite visibly scarred. She was the sexual slave of her master and of anyone he chose to share her with, which would have included members of his family. Considering what else she put up with, including the torture of one child and murder of another, this would have been among the least of her worries. She was, as we have seen, the maltreated servant of her master's women. In other ways, Rachel became entirely Comanche. She shed her pioneer clothing for Indian buckskins, and though she does not comment on it, would have been as filthy and bug-ridden as any of the Comanches, who were notable even among Indians for their lack of hygiene. She would have chopped off her long, lovely red hair. In addition to buffalo meat, which she loved, she developed a taste for prairie dogs, fat and fine to eat, beaver, the tail only, and bear, very fat and delicious food. It is doubtful that she participated in the universal Comanche habit of picking lice off themselves and cracking them with their teeth, a practice that disgusted white observers. Like other women, she probably served the men during the entertainments, fetching water for them while they danced. If she played any of the games that women and children played, shinny, double ball, she does not mention it. She knew that she was no longer in danger of being killed. She also knew that, if she remained with the tribe, her life would never change. Having failed in her plan to goad the Indians into killing her, she resolved now to persuade someone to purchase her from her captor. On the high plains, she encountered a group of Mexicans. "I tried to get one of them to buy me," she wrote. "I told him that even if my father and husband were dead, I knew I had enough land in Texas to fully indemnify him, but he did not try to buy me, although he agreed to do it." She did not give up hope. Later, while she was tending the band's horses, she encountered what she called Mexican traders, almost certainly Comancheros from New Mexico. They asked her to take them to her master, which she did. Then, in her presence, they asked him if he would sell her. Her master's shocking answer, "Sí, señor."
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.